I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be delving into the subject of America's history of foreign interventions and regime changes, with a special focus on Afghanistan. Joining us to do that is the Watson Institute's Stephen Kinzer, author of Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. Additionally, Stephen and I will discuss his April op-ed in the Boston Globe about President Biden's announcing a withdrawal from Afghanistan to be completed by September 2021. Stephen Kinzer considers this development to potentially, assuming there is follow-through on it, to be a turning of the imperial tide. We'll discuss all that and much more on this edition of Parallax Views, and now on to the conversation with the Watson Institute's Stephen Kinzer. Washington, D.C., place of stately discourse.
Beer knuckle politics and all other assorted forms of scandal. You want the dirt on the Capitol? Then check out Washington Babylon. Shocking true stories and political sleaze, edited by Ken Silverstein. WashingtonBabylon.com.
Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest I've been hoping to get on the show for quite some time now. Stephen Kinzer, author of the book Overthrow, among many others, and also the author of a recent op-ed in the Boston Globe entitled In Biden's Pledge to Withdraw from Afghanistan, the Prospect of Turning an Imperial Tide. How are you doing today, Stephen?
Doing well. I'm healthy and employed, and these days I guess that's about all we can hope for.
So before we really dive into this latest piece you wrote for the Boston Globe, and also how it ties into some of your work with the book Overthrow, which is still very useful all these years later. How did you become interested in sort of critiquing U.S. foreign policy?
So it's true. I wind up sometimes being the skunk at the foreign policy garden party. I'm a little bit off the consensus. There's always a sour note when I'm playing in the choir. I think it might come from this. Many people who work in areas of American foreign policy and international relations come out of a particular background. They're shaped by the major institutions where we study international relations. They go through congressional staffs. They work at think tanks in Washington. They go in and out of the media as commentators. And it's a certain set of assumptions that you absorb when your perspective on the world is what you absorb living in Washington. But I didn't learn about the world that way. I was a foreign correspondent for many years. As a result, I learned about American foreign policy from the people who were the victims of that policy. I saw it from the receiving end. I had a lot of opportunity traveling in dozens of countries to watch the unfolding of American foreign policy, and I didn't see it from the Washington perspective. I saw it more from the perspective of those people who were affected. This shaped my view that whenever you're writing about power, you have to write about it from the perspective of the people who are the subjects of power, the victims of power, the objects of power, not from the perspective of the people who are exercising power. So the fact that I didn't come of journalistic or political age inside the Beltway meant that I didn't absorb certain assumptions, the assumptions about American exceptionalism, the assumptions that what America does in the world is always good, the assumption that we are destined to be the dominant force in the world forever, and a whole series of other ones that tell us that there's chaos in the world when the United States is not present. The best way for us to enforce our will is by coercive power. And when we see nations or peoples who seem unwilling to accept our influence, that is a reflection of an attitude that's so backwards, it just proves how important it is for us to intervene. So I didn't absorb this idea that the United States knows what's good for the world better than the world itself knows. I developed a different perspective as a result of my experience. We're all products of our experiences, and I guess that goes a long way to explain why I see America's role in the world differently from some other people.
Now, of course, in your book, Overthrow, you pretty definitively show that our interventions in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, they're not a new phenomena within American foreign policy. I think you detail 14 different operations of regime change. So the question arises, where does this tradition of regime change really start to have its origins in America?
One could write a book to answer that question, and in fact, some people have. You can think all the way back to the first pilgrims who came here. You remember that famous speech by John Winthrop in which he said, "We shall be as a city upon a hill, and the eyes of all people are upon us." We're still arguing about what he meant. So maybe he meant the world is an evil place, and it's our job to go out and redeem it. Or maybe he meant the opposite, which is that it's our job to build a virtuous society here on our own hill. And then if it produces the results that people want, it will have an effect by people copying it. So is it an interventionist message or an anti-interventionist message? Certainly, Americans developed the idea that they were a highly exceptional people. As Herman Melville put it, we are the Israel of our times. So God's chosen people, effectively. And you actually can see this in speeches by political leaders in the 1890s and period right after 1900, when the United States first embarked on its imperial career. They say God has not been preparing the Anglo-Saxon peoples for 1,000 years for nothing. We are given the gift of knowing how to rule. Therefore, we were able to cloak our interventions, which were largely for economic and strategic purposes, in the rhetoric of liberation. I found a great speech by President McKinley, who was the one who led the United States into our first overseas imperial adventures, when we seized the Philippines and when we seized Puerto Rico and took over Cuba and so forth. So he came to Boston and made a speech to a group of businessmen and industrialists. Essentially, he's trying to defend the U.S. War in the Philippines. So this was the first time the United States ever had to send soldiers to shoot down people in another country who honestly believed that they were fighting for their own independence. How could we do that, having been founded as a nation ourselves on the principle that everyone, every nation should have self-determination? And we were founded by overthrowing a distant colony. How would you square that circle? And so what McKinley essentially said is that the Filipinos are not sophisticated or intelligent enough to understand how much they need our help. Future generations of the Filipinos will thank us for this. But in the meantime, we have to do God's work and civilize these people. So that was the rhetoric around which interventionist policies began. But below that rhetoric were other interests. In the Philippines, for example, there was considered to be a vast opportunity for resource extraction. It was also a stepping stone to the China trade, which was held up as a tremendous opportunity, just as it is today. So the idea that the United States is uniquely endowed with the knowledge and ability to rule is something that's always been powerful in our ethos. And the idea that people in different parts of the world develop different political and cultural systems according to their own situations and needs and histories, and that one way of running society doesn't fit for everybody, very difficult for Americans to absorb. Essentially, we see the entire process of history, thousands of years, just leading up to the creation of the United States, which is really the apex of all history and all civilization. And that therefore, we don't have to attend to the lessons of history. But history tells you, if you look at the countries that have survived the longest, like China or Iran, that you have to ride the currents of history. You go up, you go down. You don't rule all the time. But Americans have been unwilling to accept that. And their explanation is that we're so unique in history. There's never been anything like us. Therefore, the lessons of history don't even apply to us. And that's a very dangerous premise from which to approach the world.
So that actually brings me to the issue of Afghanistan. And I think a lot of Americans have gone through the years since 9/11, really not looking at the sort of deep history that leads up to 9/11 and everything that happens afterwards. For people that may think, oh, you know, 9/11 just happened because they hate our freedoms. It has no connection to a deeper history. What would you say to those people? What are the main flashpoints for understanding Afghanistan and where it's at today?
Well, the first thing you have to understand about Afghanistan is that its people are probably the all-time world champions at repelling foreign invaders. They've been doing that for centuries. They fought the Russians. They fought the British and defeated them. They're used in the Russians again. The territory is very difficult to control, and the people are of a nature that makes them also very difficult to control. So the stories of Afghan resistance to foreign power over the 19th century are spectacular. There's fantastic books about them. So that always has to lie in the background. There's always been this premise in imperial capitals, well, Afghanistan is just a bunch of guys in robes and sandals, and we have weapons, we're modern, we can take care of them. It's never worked out that way. So flash us into the more modern age. The United States was very eager to stoke a confrontation with the Soviet Union over Afghanistan at the height of the Cold War, and through a variety of through a whole set of circumstances, that desire for confrontation exploded after the Soviet Union sent troops into Afghanistan in 1979. There were a number of reasons why the Soviets did that, but one is particularly interesting. So think about 1979. What was the most shattering geopolitical event of that year? It was, of course, the overthrow of the Shah of Iran. So that episode was one of the rare ones that was seen as a huge loss for both Washington and Moscow. The Americans hated it, of course, because we lost our great client, the Shah. But the Soviets were also terrified by the Islamic Revolution in Iran because they were afraid of Islamic radicalism penetrating into the Soviet Union, into those Muslim republics on their southern flank. And partly to prevent that, they sent troops to invade Afghanistan. They had been lured in there in part by a policy that Zbigniew Brzezinski, the national security advisor, had very cleverly designed. In any case, the United States then seized on the fact that there were Russians in Afghanistan. We might have said, okay, we're going to wait for you to sink into the quicksand and be the infidels and be the bad guys forever, and we'll just watch while you get destroyed like all other foreign invaders in Afghanistan. But we couldn't do that. We wanted to accelerate the process. And as a result of that, the United States poured in billions of dollars along with our number one partner, Saudi Arabia, which matched our contributions dollar for dollar to create a massive force of jihadist militants that would fight the evil infidel enemy, the Soviet Union. Little did we know that we ourselves would soon become the evil infidel enemy that would fight those same troops that we trained to fight the Soviets. That was the genesis of the Taliban. Why is there such a powerful movement in Afghanistan that draws militants from all over the world? It's because the United States established a project in Afghanistan in the 1980s to fight the Soviets with an army of jihadists from all over the world. So the leaders of the insurgent forces that we were sponsoring in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets during the 1980s recruited soldiers from over 20 countries. These jihadists all turned up in Afghanistan. So the jihadists that we were sponsoring needed an organization, an office to process all these people coming from all those countries. And who did they find to do that job but a rich Arab who had just shown up from Saudi Arabia? That was Osama bin Laden. That was what he was hired to do for the Taliban. You be the guy that accepts all the foreign recruits and you keep all the files. Pretty soon, this guy had a file of every foreign jihadist in the world. They were all pouring in there. So bin Laden was part of the operation that the United States promoted in the 1980s to fight the Soviets. Then, when the Soviets finally did withdraw under Gorbachev, the Americans decided, okay, we're finished with Afghanistan. We're leaving altogether, and it's over now. Nothing bad is going to happen. This is a classic example of the American sense that history will just stop now. We had a victory, so it's over. Let's not make anything else happen. But history doesn't work that way. History keeps on happening, and these episodes have after effects. That large force that we created ended up being the spawning ground of the Taliban. That's what created the climate of 9/11. So the entire constellation of facts that led to Afghanistan becoming a global center for jihadist terror comes out of the American project. And I say, as I say, it was a multi-billion dollar project during the 1980s to recruit and train an army of Islamic militants. And those now turn out to be the people who we claim to be our enemies and the ones that we claim to be fighting for 20 years while we stayed there.
If I could, real briefly, because I know for some reason it's been coming up again in foreign policy discussions. There's been a lot of sort of establishment foreign policy types that have been pushing back on this idea that the U.S. Plays a role in the growth of this jihadism after the Soviet-Afghan conflict or during it. How would you respond to that? Because I see a lot of people say, oh, that's just a conspiracy theory. You're saying the CIA created al-Qaeda. And I think they're completely wrong in strawmanning when they make that argument.
It's true that this number one factor in the creation of these jihadi terrorist organizations was money that came not necessarily from the United States, but from allies of the United States.
Like the ISI.
I'm talking also about Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. Now, this is one of the reasons I love WikiLeaks. From those cables, I didn't learn much that I didn't already know, but I couldn't prove it before. So here's a wonderful cable that turns up from Hillary Clinton. While Hillary Clinton, as American Secretary of State, was embracing the Saudi government, which the United States has been doing all this time, she actually sends a cable in which she acknowledges that most of the funding for global terrorism is coming from the Gulf, coming from Saudi Arabia and its allies. So it wasn't possible that she didn't know that. I mean, when she got up and said Saudi Arabia is fighting terror, it was obvious that she knew the opposite was true. But now we have a WikiLeaks cable that shows that she realized this all along. If the United States had decided to let the Soviet war in Afghanistan simply unfold on its own, let the Afghans take care of it, and let the Soviets sink into the snow up there on their own accord. Don't do anything. Don't intervene. The Afghans have defeated all kinds of foreign invaders. Great. But we couldn't do that. We were so eager to give the Soviets what we called their Vietnam that we wanted to go in with heavy equipment and put this multi-billion-dollar investment to work there. So that's the episode that created the momentum that brought us to this moment of Afghanistan being infiltrated by so many terror groups from all over the world. You know, Afghanistan doesn't have a tradition like this. Up until the beginning of this process, after the Americans came into Afghanistan in 1980, there had never been a suicide bombing in Afghanistan. There's no extremist religion in Afghanistan up until this period. Afghanistan is quite a multi-ethnic state. It's always been decentralized. And until the Americans came in to stoke this conflict and until the Soviets came in to play their role, you didn't see this these kinds of horrific forces that have been tearing Afghan society apart for two generations.
And I was going to add to that. I mean, I think you could even connect some of this history to, say, Operation Ajax and the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, because, you know, later on that comes back to haunt us with the revolution. And then the revolution spreads outside of even beyond Iran, at least the sentiments do.
Absolutely. I'm a great one for tracing the historical roots of episodes. It's one of the things I hate about news. I've now decided after so many years as a newsman, I'm against news. I hate news. And the reason is news is about what's happening right now, what just happened. But that's not interesting. I read something that says a bomb went off in a building. Militants attacked an outpost in Mali. That doesn't mean anything to anybody. That doesn't tell me anything. What I want to know is not what happened today. I have two other questions that are more interesting than what happened today. One is, what happened yesterday? How did we get here? Why is what just happened happening? And the other question is, what's going to happen tomorrow? What does it mean, what just happened? Why is it important? That you don't get in news. And this is one of my great frustrations with the media. So you mentioned the overthrow of Mossadegh. So in 1953, the democratically elected prime minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, was overthrown in a coup organized by the CIA and the British Secret Service. His crime had been that he wanted to nationalize Iranian oil. So that brought the Shah of Iran back onto his throne. The Shah ruled for 25 years with increasing repression. And that repression produced the explosion of the late 1970s in Iran, what we call the Islamic Revolution. That brought to power a set of Islamic militants. And that was something that electrified radical Islamists, not just Shia, but Sunni also. They had always thought our place is in the corner of the mosque chanting. Suddenly they get a message from Iran. It's possible to seize state power. You can go way beyond just being dissidents. And this is what electrified the young Saudi millionaire Osama bin Laden. he went to Afghanistan, and in his first communique, you see what really outrages him. He talks about why he's on the warpath against the United States. And he doesn't talk about the Palestinians. He doesn't talk about any of the traditional Middle East issues that you might think about. He says there's one thing that he can't tolerate and why he has to fight America. And that was that the United States had permanently based American troops in Saudi Arabia, the land of the two holy sites of Islam. This is something that President George H.W. Bush did after the first Gulf War. We didn't think anything about that. I mean, we have troops all over the world. The Saudi government said that they'd love to have them, and they were our partners. So sure, let's post a few tens of thousands of troops there. We never thought of how that might look to people who have a particular religious and cultural connection to that land. And that is the combination of circumstances that sent bin Laden to Afghanistan. There he found a welcome from the Taliban, which, as I said, is a group that sprung partly from the American intervention in the 1980s, and then in its later phase from Pakistan. As you mentioned, it was the Pakistani ISI, the Secret Service there, that educated an entire generation of orphans who had been created by the war in the 1980s. And they only learned in their madrasas how to chant the Quran and hate America. Those were our allies. They then went back to Afghanistan, took over the government, and invited Osama bin Laden. So you can't say that bin Laden came out of nowhere. To explain horrific events is not to excuse them, but it's important to understand them. You know, the other night, I got to watch this old movie with Cary Grant. It's called Arsenic and Old Lace. And
I'm a big fan of that one.
I love this line that Cary Grant says. Actually, now that I think about it, it could be the leitmotif for my whole journalistic and writing career. And so, as you know, the story is about Cary Grant visiting his elderly aunts and then discovering that they poison the elderly guests in their guest house. So at one point, one of the aunts says to Cary Grant, "Oh, the gentleman died because he drank wine that had poison in it." And Cary Grant's eyes pop open and he says, "But how did the poison get in the wine?" That's the question that news doesn't answer. Journalism's supposed to answer that question. So the wine, for example, of our good relationship with Russia has been poisoned. How did the poison get in the wine? What happened? I like to... At the CIA, they have a great phrase. When the CIA does their internal after-operation investigations, they go back and see what went wrong before that and before that. They say, let's walk the cat back. I like that. I think when we see something that happens in the world, don't just take it at face value. Walk the cat back. If it works for the CIA, it should be able to work for us.
So before we close out this conversation, I just had one or two more questions, and I want to thank you for really giving a context to my listeners for understanding that, you know, there is such a thing as blowback, and these regime change operations really can be damaging to America, which I think brings us to this Boston Globe piece in which you quote Biden as saying, "Only the Afghans have the right and responsibility to lead their country," and that seemed to have resonated with you. Why is that?
Americans have always been torn when it comes to foreign interventions. On the one hand, we do think we should guide the world because we know best and we have good intentions. On the other hand, we want every country to do what they want. Now, those are opposites. You can't believe both of them, but we do. We try to maintain this idea that we can control the world and they'll like it anyway. So I think there's a strong sense in Washington now that the withdrawal from Afghanistan is still a dangerous idea because it suggests something that clashes with our understanding of the world. It's cognitive dissonance. And what that is the implicit understanding that maybe we didn't, maybe we're not leaving in defeat. Maybe we didn't get defeated in Afghanistan, but we failed anyway. We're certainly leaving in failure. And the United States doesn't fail in its foreign ventures. How can we be leaving without at least some fig leaf of success? I think this is a real psychological as well as a political problem. And I think there'll be intense efforts to try to make this withdrawal less than complete. So we won't take everyone out, or we'll still have some contractors, or we'll have some bases. We'll be flying operations into Afghanistan from other places. So that's my first question. Is it going to be a real withdrawal? Are we really out? Because if we are, we better get ready for the possibility of a Taliban takeover. That's the only way there's going to be peace in Afghanistan. So I see the possibility unfolding very similar to what happened in Vietnam, which I'm old enough to remember. So it was the same idea that the United States had this massive power and the Vietnamese were just these guys in black pajamas and it wasn't possible they could win. Slowly we realized that we were wrong and we had to leave in failure. So what happened afterward? Well, there was a period of harsh repression, including repression of people that cooperated with us. Then it calmed down. Another generation had come to power. I think in some ways that's already happened with the Taliban because they've been out of power, whereas the North Vietnamese had not. Then things began to loosen up in Vietnam. Vietnam became very vibrant, and Vietnam actually became a friend of the United States. I could easily see that happening in Afghanistan. But so the first question about the Biden withdrawal from Afghanistan is whether it's real or not. Are we really going to say that Afghans are the ones who can decide what happens in Afghanistan, including if they decide something we hate? Suppose the Taliban wins the coming civil war, which is quite likely. So are we going to say, oh, wait, that can't happen? Or are we really willing to leave it to the Afghans? It still remains to be seen. Then comes the next question, I would say, and that's this. If only the Afghans are the ones who should be able to decide what happens in Afghanistan, what about, say, the Syrians? Why do we need to be involved in Syria and promoting groups that are cutting that country into pieces? What about the Iraqis? What about the Libyans? There's so many countries in the world where you could apply that same phrase. So in the past, it was almost treasonous for people in territories and countries the United States controlled to say, only the people who live here know the best about how to run their country. In fact, that was exactly a line that Mossadegh used at the United Nations when he came to defend Iran's nationalization of oil. He said, the Iranian himself is the one who best knows how to run his house. We've always said that, but we've never believed it, because we believe that the one who knows how to run Afghanistan best is the same one who knows how to run Belgium best and Bangladesh best and Belize best and Burundi best and every other country that starts with a B or any other letter. And that's us. So are we really willing to say that Afghans should make their own choice and whatever happens in Afghanistan, that's not our business? Okay, if we're ready to do that, that is potentially something profound. And the logical next step is this. Going on to other countries. If it works for Afghanistan, why not the rest? So I'm not so sure that Biden is going to take it this far. I'm very pleased that he took this step, because he could have followed in the footsteps of Trump and Obama and just decided, I can't take the political risk of being the one that admits failure. So he's done that. I just hope that he carries it to the logical next step.
So in conclusion here, and I also want to thank you for writing this op-ed so honestly, because you don't gloss over the fact that, you know, the tragedies aren't necessarily going to end for Afghanistan. The suffering there isn't going to end. It may end for America when America leaves, but it's going to be a difficult time in Afghanistan. And I guess the last thing I wanted to ask, and this may come off as an odd question, but you know, I was reading a few months ago this piece by Robert Kagan in the Foreign Affairs Journal, and he was going off about America just needs to accept its role as a superpower. We need to keep, you know, being the empire, basically. why are people like Kagan wrong? How is this hurting not only other countries, but also just America itself?
Well, in the first place, it's not possible for America to control the world. We thought, particularly during the 1990s, that this was our future. I think this is where people like Kagan got their idea. Soviet Union is gone. We have placed somebody in charge of Russia, Boris Yeltsin, who's going to do everything we want. And pretty soon the whole world will be doing what America decides. It didn't work out that way. The invasion of Iraq was the real turning point. From there, we lost so much strategic power. Now, when you start a war and you lose, you can't get what you want, then the sharks start circling. And America has lost so much strategic power as a result of that disastrous decision. So it's in the coming world, in the world of the 21st century, countries are less likely to accept American dictates, particularly when there are other dictates coming from other places. In order to impose ourselves on them, we'll have to use increasing levels of coercion and violence. That's not good for them. It's not good for us. These interventions, as you suggest, often wind up not only devastating the target country, but also undermining American security. So America is now at a point where we have to readjust to a changing world. And as I said earlier, that's the key to long-term survival of a nation, to understand that you can't rule forever and that the United States is not an exception to this rule. So now we have to look forward to a period in which at best we'd be first among equals. We wouldn't be the dominant force that could dictate everything. We'd have to make compromises with other countries. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I actually believe that you can do more for the United States that way than by pushing ourselves on other countries. And that, of course, leads to the other major argument, which is, despite what our leaders have tried to tell us, you can't have both a thriving domestic society and a massive global military establishment. The United States maintains over 800 military bases in foreign countries. Everyone else in the world combined maintains about 20. There's no benefit for American security, and those bases and those enormous defense projects like new aircraft carriers and new fighter jets, which are all designed to fight the wars of the past century, as the future wars will be with drones and cyber, not with fighter jets like Top Gun. All of those projects are sucking the resources out of what we need in the United States. And this is something that sometimes frustrates me about the wonderful social justice movements that have emerged in the last couple of years. Whenever these groups promote a cause like Medicare for all or free community college tuition, they're naturally met with the response, how are you going to pay for such a huge project? There is a way to pay for it. The American defense budget takes up more than 60% of our discretionary budget. And it is sapping the resources we need. We can't have both. They used to say in the Lyndon Johnson days, we can have guns and butter. We can do it all. But that's not true, as we're seeing. America, it has some very serious domestic problems. The way for us to promote ourselves in the world is to show that we can run our own country more effectively than rival systems can do. And we're not doing that. It's not possible, for example, for the United States to slow China down or block China. Well, what we can do is become more competitive ourselves with better education and a healthier society. But we aren't understanding what national security really means. National security is not just about having supersonic airplanes and aircraft carriers. National security means having a strong society at home. And to the extent that the global hegemony project sucks resources out of that, it's anti-American. It undermines our security when we understand security in the true depth of what that word should mean.
And I would just add to that, what's so fascinating, and I think it comes out in your work, is that a lot of these figures that really do believe in this sort of global hegemony project, this, you know, the U.S. as the hyperpower, the Samantha Powers of the world. I think they really do believe that this is the role America must play. And it's not that they're, you know, necessarily evil people. They really believe it. And now it seems like the tide may be turning a bit, and we may be realizing that, no, this doesn't work out the way we think it does.
I think you're right that our foreign policy establishment generally believes that what's good for the United States is good for the world. And if the world doesn't realize it, then the world just doesn't understand as much as we understand. I think that's very true. But what I do think we have to bear in mind is that although the Washington consensus has barely changed, and we're still really in the 1990s motif where we're thinking we rule the world, the rest of the country is evolving. When you see public opinion surveys, this is very clear. Something like 70% of Americans think withdrawing from Afghanistan is a good idea. Up until 3 months ago, it was unthinkable. When you ask questions about whether the United States needs to maintain bases or what kind of an approach we should take to the world, you see clearly that there's been a change. This is something new in recent years. And it's attributable in part, I think, to Afghanistan. Americans are favoring a more restrained foreign policy. This change has not yet been reflected in Congress or in Washington. And I would love to see more efforts made at the grassroots level to make people in Washington understand that there's a change going on in the national mindset, and it would be good for the United States and the world if Congress would catch up to where the American people are.
Well, Stephen Kinzer, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. If you want, how can my listeners keep up with your writing and work and anything that you would recommend that they read from your really vast catalog of writings?
Well, I'd suggest you could look at some of my books available at your local independent bookstore, of course, like Overthrow, which is my story of 14 times the United States has overthrown foreign governments. And I also have a website. So it's stephenkinzer.com. And there's all my articles. I wrote a column every couple of weeks for the Boston Globe, and I do interviews and so forth. So you can find a lot on there at stephenkinzer.com. And torment your members of Congress.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with the Watson Institute's Stephen Kinzer, and be sure to check out his indispensable book, Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change, from Hawaii to Iraq. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Brian, Ben, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, Until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.